One thing that was not mentioned, and it's kind of ironic on this tape, considering they were interviewing, among others, Richard Helms, former interesting dual positions that he held there. If you wonder why Iranian paranoia is relatively strong against the United States to ship out the director of the CIA to be ambassador to Tehran is not particularly subtle. And in addition to that, the pivotal event in terms of linking the United States with the Shah took place earlier than anything mentioned in the tape, in 1953, in which, in brief summary, in the period right after World War II, the most dynamic politician emerging on the Iranian political scene was a man named Mohammad Mossadegh. And the issue with which he galvanized his political support was the extremely unfair terms that the Anglo-Iranian oil company had in the oil concession in Iran. And he began to press for nationalization of the oil company. The oil company gave, according to a fixed contract that had been set back in the 30s, a fixed amount of royalties to Iran, but these royalties were so small in relationship to the company's profits, which were at least six times more than the royalties that they paid. And those were profits that were taken after enormous depreciation was taken off the books and after very high taxes were paid in Britain. In fact, they paid more British income taxes than they paid royalties to Iran. So the terms were patently unfair, especially because new agreements had been made with American oil companies and the Saudis and in Venezuela, which gave them considerably better deals than the Iranians had. So he began to press for nationalization. He got a bill passed through the Iranian parliament, and at this time the Shah was a young man who was not very confident and secure and tended to be a person in the background. He operated as a monarch in name, but was not strong enough to control things, and prime ministers of the parliament, like Mossadegh, could in fact accomplish political programs. This is in the early 50s. Well, the nationalization bill went through, and then the Anglo-Iranian oil company decided that they would not allow this to happen. And they thought they could do this by pulling out all of their technicians and everyone who was trained to help get the oil out of the ground, get it onto tankers, and get it out of the Gulf, and by organizing a worldwide boycott against Iranian oil to encourage Americans and other companies not to buy the oil that the Iranians pump themselves, because then that will bring them to their knees and they'll see their senses. Mossadegh, on the other hand, felt that the Americans would support him against the British here, because the Americans would fear communist influence coming in after all, the Americans had given similar concessions to some of their oil relationships elsewhere. But the standoff continued for some time. In fact, the British refused to allow, they even had gunboats patrolling in the Gulf there, intimidating anyone from coming in to even load up any oil for a while. Well, the standoff, as I say, continued for a couple of years, from about 51 to 53. But in 1953, you had a new Republican administration in the United States, which was led in foreign policy by John Foster Dulles, a real hardliner. And you had in Britain the Labour Party being replaced by the Conservatives back again with Winston Churchill in his last term as Prime Minister, who again was an old-school imperialist. And together, essentially British intelligence concocted the plan. And then, with the cooperation of the CIA, the notion was, let's get Mossadegh out of there. How can we remove him? And this was done. essentially by hiring large numbers of street mobs and thugs with seed money to conduct a massive anti-Mossadegh demonstration. They roamed through the streets of Tehran and were also joined by aspects of the military. They sacked Mossadegh's house and placed him under arrest. And during the turmoil just before, the Shah, in fact, had fled the country because it wasn't quite clear that this was going to come off, and this was a second stage of it, the mobs in the streets. Shah had gone to Rome because he was afraid that something bad would happen to him from the pro-Mossadegh forces. But when the mobs took over in Tehran, he could fly back safely into exile, from exile back to Tehran, and then he was once again ensconced in power and Mossadegh discredited and arrested. From that point on, the Shah was much more concerned about eliminating any potential rivals that might be developed, politicians like Mossadegh or others, and within 4 years, with the help of Israeli and American intelligence, set up the SAVAK, the secret police, that would help him to police the country. So essentially from 1953 on, opposition to the Shah was much more repressed, and it was also seen very clearly that the Shah owed his position, indeed his very existence and power, to United States direct intervention. And as he continued to pursue policies that were essentially anti-communist in the 50s and 60s, this was good. And to protect American business interests, he found that it wasn't really necessary for him to open up the political system or do any of those other kinds of things which may in fact be on the American agenda but which were not as high as anti-communism and protection of American economic interests. So when the reforms that were mentioned in 63 began, they were denounced by Khomeini. Helms referred to them as land reforms. That was one aspect of the program. And certainly that did threaten the clergy to some degree in Iran because a number of the lands were held by in trusts for the support of the clergy, and that was one of the things that made them independent of the state. And this would have been one of the things that they perhaps would have had threatened if some of these land reforms had gone through. But there were other reasons, too. And anyway, they were denounced as another of the steps of pro-Westernization by Khomeini and his followers in the 1963 uprising there. As to why the revolution particularly took place in the late 70s, a couple of factors probably need to be highlighted here. One would, of course, be what occurred in the early 70s, particularly if we remember in relation to the Yom Kippur War, the Arab-Israeli War, the Arab OPEC countries organized an oil boycott which quadrupled the price of oil overnight. This was of tremendous benefit, even though they weren't a participant in the boycott initially, but a tremendous benefit to Iran. Because as the second largest oil producer after Saudi Arabia, they found their income swelling massively overnight. Some indication, I think Iran went from $2 billion in income the year before the boycott to $20 billion the year after, an increase of 10 times. In a single year, and then that massive amount of money pretty well continued through the early 70s. This massive influx of money was in many ways a poison chalice for Iran, I suppose you could say in retrospect. What happened to the money? Well, certainly one of the things that happened to the money was in a rather ingenious but cynical policy derived by, in part, by Kissinger. There were a couple of things that were happening simultaneously. One was that Britain was removing itself from the Persian Gulf. It could no longer afford to maintain its military stations there. They had traditionally had alliances with all those small Gulf state kingdoms there, and they were now turning these territories like Dubai, Abu Dhabi, and United Arab Emirates and things into independent countries, but and then withdrawing their military from those areas. This meant, from the United States' point of view, that the Gulf, with all of its oil, was now devoid of any policing power that was favorable to the West. The Shah had big ambitions. He wanted to be the policeman of the Gulf. He wanted to be a major military power in the region. So what better way to recycle all those petrodollars than to sell the Shah massive amounts of military equipment and aid so that we not only help our defense industries, we get the money back that we're paying extra for the oil, and it comes back. There's evidence, in fact, that in the first couple of meetings of OPEC after the boycott, that the Saudis, who tended to get blamed at the time for this whole thing, were willing to bring the price back down a little bit. After all, it was initially jacked up as a result of a political demand regarding the war, and then after were prepared to increase production and so forth. But the Shah now was the most militant about holding prices high. And apparently he was secretly supported in this by Kissinger because he needed to have the wealth needed to buy the arms. And so this was a way, in fact, although United States policy at the time officially was that we deplore all this tremendous rise in oil prices. In fact, we acquiesced at rather high levels there as a way of transferring this particular military obligation to the Shah. Second thing that the Shah was doing with the money was, quite frankly, lining his own pockets and the pockets of his close kinship network and supporters. It's still not known exactly how much was siphoned off by the Shah and his family to Swiss bank accounts, real estate in Beverly Hills, other kinds of places. But massive amounts were, and everyone who was doing business with Iran in the 1970s knew that substantial amounts of, let's call it seed money, were required to win the massive contracts that were available now. Skyscrapers going up all over Iran, large kinds of concerns. There were lots of building and construction projects going on. Almost all of them, again, by the way, centered in urban areas. Very little of this wealth then being deflected to the countryside, to the masses, resulting in an in-migration, as in many other third world countries, of poor people from the countryside into the cities, where it's difficult again for them to find work. They live in shanty towns, and they are also confronted with this paradox of this massive wealth that's concentrated now in the urban areas and this modern private sector that is booming on the one hand, and yet they having a very hard hand-to-mouth existence on the other. Certainly, one could argue that they would be susceptible to people who were going to offer them an alternative. There are a whole host of people, actually, who were involved in, and it was alluded to in the tape, who were involved in the overthrow of the Shah and the revolution. Often in retrospect, when we realize, or we now know, of course, that the religious party and Khomeini won out in the revolution, there's often a tendency to project back and assume that this was the party that started the revolution and carried it out as well. But we have to remember, just as in many other revolutions, oftentimes there is a coalition of forces that is involved in the overthrow of the existing government, and then there's an internal squabble among those forces as to who will emerge afterwards. Remember, of course, it's a question that will always appear on freshman European history exams or something. Who overthrew the Tsar, and it wasn't the communists that overthrew the Tsar. There was a popular revolution first, and the Bolshevik revolution, the communist revolution, took place 6 months afterwards. There are often stages, and Crane Britton, the scholar of topology of revolution, his topology has in fact been applied in some cases to the Iranian Revolution as well, in terms of going through radical phases, which may just be coming to an end now before we're having a more moderating phase. We'll have to wait and see. But in any case, this coalition of forces that overthrew the Shah probably needs to be mentioned just as a way of understanding some of the things that were going on in the period right after the revolution, particularly the hostage crisis, for example, which so preoccupied Americans and first tuned us into this revolution in great detail. Remember that the Shah had very few friends in Iran. Anybody who was interested in democratic ideas and liberal expression of those was an opponent of the Shah. And there were people like that who, going back to the time of Mossadegh, saw him in a kind of liberal nationalism as a kind of wing of opposition to the Shah. And that group of people, by the way, had taken great heart by Carter's human rights emphasis in foreign policy, and they had begun to petition the Shah to make constitutional changes and to become a little bit more vociferous in their opposition as a result of the signals that they were getting from the Carter administration. There had also developed in Iran by the early 70s a couple of guerrilla movements that were in active, violent opposition to the Shah and which had two different orientations. One was a kind of Marxist, Maoist-style guerrilla ideology, a group called the Fedayini Khalq. And another was a group called the Mujahideen, who were attempting to use guerrilla warfare with Islam and Islamic ideals as their ideology. There were also people that I would call Islamic modernists, people who believed that the combination of Islam and Western technology, etc., could be made to work in Iran if it were only done in a more politically equitable fashion and a politically more egalitarian fashion, as well as the followers of Khomeini and some of his people who were involved in the opposition. But all of these groups, and student groups I can mention too, were responsible for bringing people into the streets for the demonstrations. For the demonstrations themselves, there's a kind of interesting cultural phenomena in Iranian Islam that kept the ball rolling. And that is that it's customary to have 40 days of mourning for a person who is killed or dies, actually, and then everyone gathers and commemorates the person on the 40th day. So what would happen with a street demonstration in which violence would break out, police or troops would kill some people, you would have then 20 or 30 people who had been martyred and whose funerals would be one occasion, and then the 40-day mourning period, 40 days later than that, there would be almost automatically another massive demonstration for all those people who remembered what had happened 40 days previously. That would often create another demonstration where more people would be killed, and you know it would simply be an ongoing cycle. In other words, you didn't really have to organize those kinds of demonstrations. They were built into the natural cycle of the way in which Iranians mourned someone who had died. Certainly, the other thing that you had in Iran that needs to be highlighted here, and this connected back with Shiism, is the role, you know, and they call them the clergy. And although there's something troubling about calling them the clergy, that's probably a little bit more accurate in Iran than anywhere else in the Muslim world. But we have to be careful about using this term clergy in relationship to Iran. The term ulama that's a plural term, is the term used for Islamic scholars. I was talking about this last time, or yesterday, when we were discussing the fact that the vast majority of the intellectual tradition of Islam went into legal scholarship. People who studied the Quran, the Hadith, the consensus juristic opinions that had evolved over the years, generally called ulama. But they aren't clergy in the most of the Islamic world in the sense that they operate as intermediaries between the people and God. They don't perform ritual functions in any case. There are no sacraments in Islam. I mean, there's not the equivalent of a Islamic ritual that needs to be done at the various stages in life. There are things that have evolved by custom there, but they aren't really don't have the sacramental stage to it where you need a clergyman to officiate at these kinds of things. And as a result, there is more limited status and influence, varying more with the person than with the office for various ulama in parts of the world. But with Shiism, the position of the ulama is higher. And it's higher because, in part, they have a unique responsibility, that of being mujtahids. Mujtahid. This is connected back with the power and authority of the imams. And remember, in Iran, the brand of Shiism here is 12-er imamism that I mentioned last time, in which the 12th of the imam had disappeared as an infant. And in order to conduct things in according to his will, various interpreters of his will needed to give authoritative opinions. It meant because the imam disappeared last that the building up of Shia legal tradition was later starting than that of the Sunnah, so it didn't have as much precedent that was binding on it. And secondly, it meant that there was more scope given for individual interpretation and new and creative forms of interpretation by individual authority figures here with the Shias than with the Sunnis. The last factor that's important here in looking at the position of Iranian ulama is that because for most of the history of Shiism, the Shias never had political power, the mujtahids often were in the position, at least for their followers, of making critical comments about the political authority and advising sometimes their followers to rebel against them or not to follow them in certain circumstances. Whereas, as we mentioned last time, with the ulama in most Sunni countries, the ulama have traditionally been subservient to the state authority in exchange for the state enforcing the Islamic law as interpreted by the ulama. So, in Iran, there was a tradition that the ulama often served as opposition to the government and were far more independent, in part also because they had, as I mentioned, independent sources of income. In many other places, the ulama were appointed by the state, paid by the state, etc., which is another way of co-opting them. The term Ayatollah is simply a title of respect which goes to the most prestigious of the mujtahids. And it is not a single title that is given at one time. In other words, there are numerous Ayatollahs in Iran, even today, and there were during the time of the Ayatollah Khomeini. But it is a relative handful who have that particularly prestigious title and puts them in the top rank and the most authoritative of those who interpret the law. The title is gained essentially by consensus of one's peers. There is no formal ordination to it or bestowing of it in the form of a university degree or anything of that nature. It is something that you earn in the course of your career and reputation and become known and granted that title by the way in which people address you and use it. Those factors all helped make the Iranian clergy, if you will, if you want to call them that, the ulama, the mujtahids, and the lower-ranking people, the one area during the period, the one institution, I should say, during the period of the Shah's strongest repression that was able, in some fashion or other, to express dissent. Certainly political parties who were interested in dissent couldn't gather together. But every Friday noon at the major prayer of the week where a sermon was given, there would be a large congregation in front of you. And sermons could be given. Shia history, which you saw the little blurb again, reminded you of Amir Hussein, the martyr, is full of interesting little incidents which not too subtly could be used as analogies to the present situation. And the clerics were very effective at identifying the Shah with Yazid, the man who led the army that killed Amir Hussein, and that any time a member of the clergy was persecuted or so forth, he could be identified with Amir Hussein or other imams later on. By the way, this tradition of martyrdom goes all the way through. It starts with Amir Hussein, but the 12 imam or Shias believe that every single imam was killed or poisoned or something, you know, done away with in some fashion like this. So this is a natural reaction from the evil state will always be after the righteous man. These factors allowed the mosques to become the places for dissent, and as the tapes indicated, there were spread through Iran initially. It was, again, primarily through the mosques and the schools associated with the mosques that these were initially disseminated as well. The Shah was always ambivalent about how far he should go in trying to crack down on this stuff. He recognized that there were strong popular feelings on behalf of Islam, and he realized the power that the mujtahids held in the country, and yet if he didn't, he was also worried if they would be able to build up a great deal of opposition. But he certainly greatly underestimated how much their organization had developed effective ways of connecting throughout Islam, primarily with, ironically enough, rather modern technology and their adaptation to it. Whereas, so that if a demonstration was called, it could be done through the mosque network in many, many cities throughout Iran simultaneously on the same day. Didn't have to worry about slower communications and things of that nature. Well, because a number of different groups, as I said, were involved in the overthrow of the Shah initially, when certain student groups seized the American embassy and took the hostages, Khomeini used, I think in retrospect, the hostage crisis to maneuver out those other factions from the government. I don't know if you even remember the characters who used to appear on TV back then. Bani Sadr, Gotsbazadeh, people like that. Well, these were modernists. These were like Bonnie Sauter had been an economist trained at the Sorbonne. He was a person, though, who believed, was a supporter of Khomeini, too, because he was a very strong modernist Muslim who believed that you could combine, again, Western-style political institutions and economic planning, etc., with Islam. But Khomeini's idea was that no, the only really Islamic government was a government under the control of the Mujtahids. And he needed to eliminate all of these other people who had ambitions and who thought, whether they were democratic liberals or communists or all the other types. And so he let the fray sort of go on. It was hard to get any kind of a reading on it. He gave contradictory messages or no messages at all. But the people left out to dry were the official holders of offices, like prime ministers and presidents, who appeared to be indecisive, ineffectual, and not even in control of situations in their own country. I mean, it was clear that they weren't able to influence the students either. And, you know, as a result, I'm fairly convinced that the hostage crisis went on as long as it did, in part for domestic political considerations in Iran, as much as for showing any particular xenophobic effects on the U.S. It was one of the means that was used to consolidate the mullah's hold on the Iranian revolution.
Would it have happened by accident?
I don't know if we'll ever know for certain about this, but it appears from everything we've been able to tell that it was a rather spontaneous act, that it wasn't, you know, Khomeini giving the word to somebody, go out and do this, but that once it happened, he took advantage of it and used it in that fashion. A new constitution and a new was rammed through after a plebiscite declaring the country now an Islamic Republic, and a new constitution was run through that embodied some of Khomeini's ideas about how this ought to be organized. And it's interesting, again, what role Khomeini chose for himself in this new Islamic Republic. He took for himself a title which is a phrase derived from much further back. It literally means the guardianship of the country by the clergy is the phrase, but it was modified to be now, instead of the clergy, by the supreme religious authority, which he took upon for himself. And what this meant in his own eyes, in some general sense, was that he would be above the government as a kind of overseer who would judge and make sure that the government's actions were always in accordance with the Sharia. But he would take no active role in day-to-day government or day-to-day policy. I think, you know, in some ways this was being acted out right away from the beginning in what I was talking about relating to the hostage crisis. He had no official position. He had no title. He had no ambitions to be president or prime minister or anything of that nature. Far better to let other people be saddled with the responsibilities of that, and he can sit way above the fray and be the deus ex machina who, you know, intervenes when necessary, when things go wrong. But there are always scapegoats out there for elimination if something does go wrong. The notion then that he brought forth about what this Islamic state would be is characterized by, for example, what the parliament ought to do. There is an elected parliament in Iran, and in some ways the elections that have been held in the Islamic Republic have been the freest elections that have ever been held in the history of Iran. There have been candidates that have been free to run in opposition to one another. But one point needs to be mentioned here, which is that this is a parliament that does not legislate. There's no need for legislation in an Islamic state because all the laws have already been created. They are in the Shariat. All the parliament does is set an agenda for actions, maybe, that could carry out programs, and those programs have to be seen to be in accordance with Islamic law and the Shariat, and of course the Supreme Religious Guide would be the ultimate judge as to whether or not they are. But as far as the details of those kinds of programs, there's a fair amount of flexibility, and certainly it has been throughout the first 10 years of the revolution, relatively little guidance at all from Khomeini about what they should be. The result has been, in fact, that there are, even within the Islamic militant parties within Islam and in the parliament itself, a good deal of political debate about what kinds of programs should be implemented. Some who are much more radical in the social and political, social and economic changes that they want, including more radical land reform, etc., and others who are much more conservative. But there may be scope, in fact, for either of those. They have to wait and see when they finally bring it to the Supreme Religious Authority whether or not he will approve of this, but the debate is allowed to go on in that respect. One other thing about the system set up by Khomeini that also needs to be mentioned is that for political novices, these guys did a very good job of building a network of political, well, participation and, well, I'm not going to use the word participation. Let's say a grassroots political network that was far superior to anything that the Shah had ever done. And this served a couple of functions. There were the creation of a number of social welfare agencies under Islamic rubrics and other kinds of neighborhood, local, political, religious organizations, which served as a kind of sounding board for people to give grievances and opinions about the particular policies that were coming down, and to allow the regime to have a fair amount of intelligence about what the mood of the people was in relationship to things, and at least give them the opportunity, as I say, to vent these things. It sort of reminds me in some ways of the block system that worked in China under Maoism, in which you had the little local gatherings and self-criticism society sometimes they turned into, but at least it was also an effective way for the regime to keep its finger on the pulse of what was happening down there, and also for people to at least appear to be able to express something on the way up. That was something the Shah had totally lost touch with, and one of the reasons he had no clue as to what was happening, because he was surrounded by sycophants and yes men, and he never had that kind of a widespread organization. This is one of the things that would lead one to believe that the system set up here is deeply enough entrenched so that it is not immediately going to pass by the way just because Khomeini is gone. There are some aspects to it that are highly practical and have functioned fairly well. But there are a lot of other aspects that are still quite vague and which did depend upon Khomeini's unique leadership, and those will be sorely tested now as we come to the future. One other thing that probably needs to be mentioned about the revolution, and again there's some interesting parallels with both the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution here, is that the day of reckoning for the Islamic Revolution is probably just coming now. Not just because Khomeini died, but because earlier this year, or last year I should say, truce finally was made in the Iran-Iraq war. And just as in the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution, when you're invaded by an outside force, it has a way of coalescing all groups within the society, making them willing to make lots of sacrifices, and believe me, they have, not only in terms of the blood of people killed in the war, but of course hardships economically and so forth. Well, all of that could be done in the name of protecting the country. And the fact that it has to be remembered, and sometimes I in talking with people, I'm surprised they forget, because Iran becomes the big boogeyman, but it was Iraq that attacked Iran. It was a rather sneaky move by Saddam Hussein, who felt that with the chaos of the Iranian Revolution, he would have a good shot at getting in there and gaining back some territory that he had lost by treaty to the Shah earlier. And it would be a cheap and easy victory, and he turned out to be very wrong in the way in which he estimated what the Iranian response to that would be. But in any case, that war, sustained for as long as it did, sort of postponed the day of reckoning for the revolution. Now, the revolution is going to have to deliver the promises and expectations that people held of it, regardless of what promises and expectations were made by people in the revolution. It's what people are expecting from it. And that will be what a lot of people believe to be its downfall. All I would add to that, before maybe giving you a chance to ask a couple questions here, is that just remember for at least 3 to 4 years, and then they finally gave up on it, everybody predicted that the Iranian revolution would fail from almost the outset. This can't last long. These people are too disorganized. These people don't know what they're doing. Their economy is in shambles. If their economy is in shambles, it's been in shambles for 10 years, and they've not only survived, but managed, at least on the face of it, I haven't gotten the news lately, managed even a fairly peaceful transition when Khomeini died. They have developed a committee that is allegedly, maybe in the interim, we'll see, is going to take the place of Khomeini in terms of fulfilling this constitutional role as supreme religious guide, and we'll see where it goes from here. So it's not necessarily too soon here to make a blanket statement that the revolution now is about to collapse, but they do certainly have serious problems, and now in peacetime, they're going to have to make some real meaningful changes in the conditions of existence for the average person there, probably, to see whether or not Islam as an ideology can succeed where Western-style ideologies and economic systems and political systems seem to have failed, as far as many of the people here are concerned. Anyone want to jump in?
Well, you were distinguishing between Shiites and the other type of
Sunni Muslims. In terms of the way in which the role of the clergy is played, or the ulama here.
Is Iran largely Shiite?
Yes, I should have said that at the outset. Although Shiites are 10% of the total Islamic population, Iran is well over 90% Shiite.
And that's unique among
That's the unique. Others. However, Iraq, ironically, is the only other major nation besides Lebanon now, probably Lebanon. Well, Lebanon doesn't have a majority. It's the biggest single group in Lebanon are the Shiites, but they're not a majority of the population. But Iraq is the only other major Arab country, or major Islamic country, I should even say, that is also majority Shiite. 55% of the population of Iraq is Shiite. That was one of the reasons, in fact, in both ways there was such hostility. Khomeini believed that he could topple Saddam Hussein by appealing to the Shiites in Iraq and having them, he hoped, become a substantial fifth column against the Iraqis. The Iraqi government bought off the Shias with a variety of policies. And the Arab-Persian tensions were strong enough to perhaps surmount the Shia affinities in that particular case. Well, I think we're getting close to chance to make the early supper, if you want, if there are no further questions. We'll wrap that up then.
Let me ask you another question. Would there be any parallels with this revolution and the potential for what might happen in China? Totally.
I don't think so. I mean, I'd rather talk about some possibilities or parallels in other countries in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And even there, there are a lot of different conditions. There are a lot of things about Iran that are unique. And it's hard for me to picture a similar regime developing anywhere else because of the unique history of Shiism and the particular role that Khomeini has played in this particular.
Yeah, I guess there was some concern about Egypt.
Well, yeah. Now, Egypt has got a strong fundamentalist movement, and Saturday I was going to use Egypt as an example to talk about that. But it's a different kind of movement, not led by necessarily ulama. They don't have exactly the same agenda, and it would be very difficult. In fact, they don't have literature out there yet as to what kind of a state they have in mind if they were to get power.
They tend to
be very critical of what exists. They also tend to be people who believe that, well, once a society is running according to Islamic law, then everything should be hunky-dory. I mean, we should have an ideal state. That's the answer. You know, it's the bullet that will cure all ills and problems. If you're a fundamentalist Muslim, that's the answer. And so you don't worry so much about blueprints or plans because
all you got to do is
get into power and follow it, and supposedly all things will work out the way they're supposed to. That'll be, you know, questionable. The longer that the Iranian revolution goes, of course, it provides a model, either positively or negatively, for fundamentalists elsewhere in the Islamic world. If they seem to be doing well, then it encourages them. But there's no doubt that if they stumble and fall badly in the next 5 years or so, it will certainly hurt the cause of fundamentalists elsewhere in terms of recruiting new people too. Because one of the strong appeals of it right now is that it's an alternative. It's something that hasn't been tried in the whole region ever, right? And it holds great promise, and it's consistent with our traditions, you know, and it's ours, it's our own. We don't have to import this from somewhere else, and besides, we've imported stuff from elsewhere, and it doesn't work. Initially, when countries were under colonial rule, they figured all they had to do was get political independence, and then they'd catch up real quickly. And so you'd have a generation of leaders in the first couple of decades after these countries achieved their independence who would slavishly be following Western models of development and Western matters in all respects as a way of catching up. But instead, the gap keeps getting farther and farther apart. And other tensions that are introduced into the society as a result of these reforms create all kinds of feelings of alienation and discouragement as well. And so there's a reaction, I believe, now going on, not only in the Middle East, but in many other parts of the world, too, that have gone through the colonial experience right after World War II and have now passed through a couple of generations of failure at this, who are looking for new ideologies, looking for new methods and ways. But what are there out there? I mean, communism has been discredited. Socialism doesn't work. The capitalist system doesn't work. What are we to turn to? What are we going to find? Right now, this is the first new idea that's come down the pike, a new old idea, but it's a new idea in terms of the way in which it's being implemented. And so it has a very strong appeal to people. I think it has to run its course. It has to also be shown to either work or not work before it passes to from the scene and something else emerges. But right now, I think the revivalists have got the leg up on people, and they're likely to continue, I think, as a, if you want to view it from the Western point of view, a problem or at least a force within this part of the world for the rest of the century. I've arbitrarily said another 10 years at least of concern here about Islamic revival.
The succession now, who's going to succeed Khomeini as the chief guy according to the Constitution?
According to the Constitution, it can be a committee.
Oh, it can be.
Yeah, and that seems to be what's likely to happen.
There's
no one who at all approaches his stature, right? So that would be the likely short-term solution, and it would be interesting to see if it can be a stable one, or whether or not power struggles within that group would cause it to break down or what? Someone to emerge. That's something we'll be watching, I suppose, in the in the short term.
Very interesting. Tomorrow is on Lebanon.
Yeah. Well, there's Shiites in Lebanon. We'll talk about a little influence from Khomeini and then also the rather unique conditions there. Yes.
Is the leader of Iran right now, is he similar to Khomeini?
Well, he's not similar in the sense that he's not considered by the people to be as important a person. He has some of the same beliefs that Khomeini has, or the men that are in charge maintain their that they are still believing the same things that Khomeini believed. They haven't changed the way in which they are going to direct the state. At least that's what they are saying. But the man who was officially given Khomeini's position is not a man who is as important as Khomeini, even though he's right now temporarily holding the position. And it may be, again, one of these cases in which you put someone in there who is not going to be a threat to become... He's allied with the guy who's... actually, his name is quite similar. It's Khamenei rather than Khomeini. And he's allied with, at least he's said to be allied with, the guy who is the Speaker of the Parliament, Rafsanjani, who is widely regarded to be the most effective politician that's operating. But he doesn't have the religious credentials to move up the ladder to that position. So the best thing for him might be to get somebody who is malleable enough there, who's not a strong personality himself, but who could be working in tandem with them. That's what
somebody would have sufficient